No one wants a life filled with adversity, but our guest this hour says adversity has its benefits, and we should try to learn from the bad things that happen to us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I am sure you have heard of our guest. Maybe you have heard him on Wisconsin Public Radio in the past. He is a pioneer in the diagnosis and treatment of the condition SAD, seasonal affective disorder. But today we are going to talk with him about something else, something sad sometimes, sad events that happen to us, bad things that happen to us, traumatic things that happen to us. We'll talk about the latest research about and his personal experiences with adversity. And we'll find out why he says it can be a gift. And we'll wonder if you've ever learned an important lesson from adversity. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Dr. Norman Rosenthal, clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, where he was the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder, and he pioneered the use of light therapy to treat it. His most recent book is The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Rosenthal.
It's a pleasure.
So what made you decide to look at the topic, the issue of adversity?
Well, I think that many of us, when we reach a certain point in our lives, look at our lives and say, what are the events that have taught us things? Our life lessons, if you want to call it that. And whenever I've asked people what they like the most about my books, Winter Blues, The Emotional Revolution, Transcendence, I always think they're going to say, oh, your scientific explanations are so interesting. Well, nothing of the kind. They like the stories. Tell us stories, stories from your own life. So I thought, okay, let me tell stories from my life where I learned something. And as I looked through the stories, to my astonishment, I found that when I learned the most was when something went wrong. A mistake, a piece of bad luck, some imperfection, and that is how it came to me, an insight that by no means unique to me. It's gone back to Nietzsche and Shakespeare and all kinds of people that, you know, what doesn't kill you sometimes makes you stronger.
Yeah, if it doesn't kill you.
If it doesn't kill you.
And you had a near-death experience I didn't know about. You were, please tell us about this. You were stabbed repeatedly in the abdomen, and how that experience changed you.
Yes, it changed me a lot, actually. I was a young man, and I was out on a date with a girlfriend, and I was in a car, and we were just yakking away in a quiet, shady lane. It sounds shady, but yeah. It wasn't. It mm-hmm. was just very sweet and innocent until the windshield got shattered, and, you know, we drove on the right-hand side, thank heavens. So when the 18-inch screwdriver came at me, it came into my right-hand side instead of into the left, which would have been the end, because that's, of course, where the heart is. So, you know, I fended the guys off, and we screamed and honked, and, you know, miraculously got to the hospital in time, and the surgeon said if it had gone a quarter of an inch the other way, it would have hit my aorta and that would have been it, but it wasn't. And so when I survived, when I came round, I was full of the most amazing appreciation of being alive that I have ever had. But I will never forget it. I will never forget that sense of how wonderful life is, how valuable it is, how we need to use every day, enjoy every day. It gave me a lifelong appreciation for the value of every single day. I mean, it was a very heavy price to pay for the lesson, and I wouldn't recommend it, but it was a huge lesson that came out of that event.
That, of course, a very traumatic experience. You talk a little bit about what's called post-traumatic growth.
Yes, yes. This is quite an interesting concept, even, you know, relatively novel to me, because we've all heard of post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is, of course, you know, when you get traumatized and you get flashbacks and vigilance and nightmares and you can't sleep, and it's an awful thing. But it turns out that many traumatized people actually grow as people. Their psychological sophistication, their psychological strength ends up being greater than it was at the beginning as a result of the trauma and how they deal with it. And to my amazement, there are more than 3,000 professional articles written on this particular subject.
Yeah, and
so clearly it's a fascinating concept that we all need to know more about.
And this, the research says that some trauma produces growth, but having too much, I mean, you don't want to have a life filled with trauma and adversity. You're not going to, it's just going to wear you out, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, there is science on that, where they took people with almost no adversity and people with the middle amount and people with an overwhelming amount, and they tested their resilience. And the middle amount seems to be the best. You don't want to have this overwhelming trauma that's actually not going to be good for you at all.
Now, the book isn't about all, you know, something spectacularly big or a trauma like you're being stabbed. There are ordinary, everyday adversities that we can pull lessons from?
Yes, of course, because, you know, most adversities are small adversities. And the joy is to know that we can learn a lot from those, too. And, for example, just learning how your brain works. Everybody's brain works differently. And, for example, my brain is terrible when it comes to a sense of direction, but it's pretty good when it comes to, you know, remembering names. So when I was a little boy, I remembered all the names between my home and my grandmother's home, and people thought that was very smart. But it was really, it was a compensation. But I think there's a lesson there, and that is that everybody has got certain weaknesses. Everybody looks the same, perhaps, but their brains are not the same. So everybody's got certain weaknesses that they are saddled with, but then most of us have also got some hidden strengths, and we need to develop those. A lot of times I see, as a psychiatrist, a lot of energy being put into remediating problems and not enough into really developing areas of brilliance. So I think that that was a lesson there. But the very first lesson in the book is really a tiny little story, but it's been quite important for me. I was in grade school cutting out, along with all the other children, a clown out of cardboard. We cut out the body parts of the clown, and then we articulated them together with fasteners so that the clown could do jumping jacks. And because of my terrible eye-hand coordination, as I came down the arm and I saw the thumb sticking out, long and slender and difficult, I thought, my God, I'm not going to get round that thumb. And I looked at this guy. Not only had he gotten round the thumb, but he was like barreling up the other side of the arm. And I thought, what's going to happen here? And then I made an executive decision. The thumb must go. I clipped it off in one clip and went round the hand. It was all fine, and then got to the other arm, and obviously I couldn't have a clown with only one thumb, so that one just went automatically. And the interesting thing to me about that is that there was very little consequence to the whole thing. You know, somebody said, oh, the clown doesn't have thumbs, but nobody paid much heed to it. And the clown did jumping jacks just like all the other clowns. And what I realized is that sometimes it's okay to cut corners in life. And many years later, when I did a pivotal study, which was my most important experiment ever, comparing bright and dim light in people with seasonal affective disorder, we didn't have much budget. So we had to basically, you know, rig up this light box, which was very inartfully done. But basically, it's all we could afford. I cut the corners, I snipped off the thumbs, and the experiment succeeded and actually has become my most highly cited paper. So I just say to people out there, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, if there are things that are very, very, very important to get right, you can't snip off the thumb. But a cardboard clown is not one of those things.
Well, it's a good thing that you snipped off the thumbs of that clown, I guess. How can people learn to look for positive lessons when they, you know, face setbacks or difficulties?
You know, I think it's important not to underestimate the pain and the difficulty of the trauma. But mostly people are pretty much in touch with that. You know, let's say you're divorced from somebody and you just want the son of a gun out of your life. He's been nothing but trouble since the day he arrived. I would say, wait a sec. There must have been some nice times. Take a moment. Think of what made you fall in love with this person in the first place and why you got together. Now, what's the point of doing that? The point of doing that is to remember you weren't an idiot to marry this person. There was a real attraction. There were some really appealing qualities. He or she seemed like the right person at the time. You made the best judgment you could. And you had some good times and you made a mistake. That's all. You made a mistake, and he or she made a mistake. Now try to learn something from the mistake. So it's just a shift in the way you tell yourself the story. And a chapter in the book says, turn it into a story. Because when you tell a story, you create a narrative, you make connections, your clever left side of your brain that analyzes things and verbalizes things collaborates with your emotional right side of the brain, and the two of them kind of get together and you write it down. And there's a ton of research that shows that all kinds of good things happen when you do that. For example, it improves rehiring in fired workers. It improves immune functioning. All kinds of things improve when you tell a story, and especially when you write it down. And I do include an exercise based on the wonderful work of my colleague James Pennybaker at the University of Texas. I include an actual exercise for people indicating to them how they can write about their traumas in a very time-limited way, just a total of 1.5 hours over maybe 10 days. And that has a really demonstrated controlled study effect on all kinds of good things.
Well, we invite listeners to talk about those traumas on the air right now. Traumas or setbacks or mistakes or any type of adversity. We're talking about what we can learn when bad things happen to us and why our guest says that we can actually benefit from adversity. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to join in with your questions or your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School, and his most recent book is The Gift of Adversity: The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Have you ever benefited from adversity? What lessons have you learned from something bad that happened to you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We welcome your questions and we welcome your stories. Dr. Rosenthal, talk a little bit more, please, about why you call adversity a gift. How do we benefit from adversity?
Well, there are many ways. Suffering, which adversity involves, leads to empathy. Being blocked or prevented from doing something leads to creative solutions and workarounds. Loss leads to growth. And so it goes that each kind of adversity comes with a certain gift along with it. And so, you know, I go through all kinds of little different adversities and I show things that have emerged from them. For example, take towards the end of the book, I have a section on heroes. Now, one of the heroes was Viktor Frankl. He was a neurologist in Vienna before the Second World War who stayed on because he didn't want to leave his family and his patients. And along with millions of other people, he was hauled off into the death camps where he lost his parents, his wife, friends, and nearly died himself. Okay, so reasonable question would be to say, what possible gift could come from such horrendous adversity? And yet, when he came out of the death camps, he came with a message of universal hope and a philosophy that has been helpful to millions of people. He wrote his great book, Man's Search for Meaning, and the key lesson in that book is that even when things are so bad that there's nothing you can do about them, the one thing you can change is how you view them, your attitude towards the world. And so that particular insight led to a whole approach of therapy and many books, and I was lucky enough to meet Viktor Frankl, which is why he's in my book, because I've included in my book mostly or almost exclusively people I've personally come across. Otherwise, the universe of people with adversity would just have been unmanageably large. But I actually met him, and he was 90 years old, and it was wonderful to feel myself in the presence of this great man who'd made such a great contribution, still crystal clear, and looking back over this dramatic, eventful century. So there you are. That's an example, an unexpected example of a gift coming from the most unlikely place.
Let's take our first caller. Shelley in Madison is with us. Hello, Shelley.
Hello. Thank you for the show. In June 2010, I had a very minor fall. I ruptured several discs in my back and broke some vertebrae, had surgery by wonderful surgeons at St. Mary's. And then I did something again, and it happened again, and I ruptured more discs. Right after that, I had a small accident, broke six bones in my foot. So the upshot was, for 3 years, I was on cast or on crutches and in cast and spent a long time just recovering. And I learned to appreciate so much. I learned to appreciate how much less pain I had, as painful as it was, how much less pain I had than people who suffer with lifelong situations, how much people cared for me, how lucky I was to have good health care. The lessons go on, and there is not a day that doesn't go by that I don't appreciate the ability to move and to have good health.
Yeah. Gratitude. Dr. Rosenthal?
Well, you know, my first response when I hear something else is just overwhelming joy that there are people out there who are capable of processing adversity in such a positive way, who can look at the good side, at the silver linings, and be grateful and thankful and see joy even in the midst of hard times. But I think that it is really an amazingly wonderful part of the human spirit to be able to do that. Now, if for some reason somebody out there has a hard time doing that, it's just good to know that it is possible to do that. So if somebody is in the middle of an adversity and they're not seeing any gifts and they don't see any gifts ever coming, just to say, you know, here is Shelley. Look, she's suffered a lot of things and she's been able to find them and others have been able to find them. Why don't we take a little look here and see if there's any good news that we can pull out of what is essentially a very difficult situation. So I think that the book and stories like Shelley's are like a beacon of hope to those who are suffering and despairing and feeling like there's no light in this tunnel at all.
Okay. Shelley, thank you for the call and thank you for the hope. Ingrid in Franklin is with us. Hello, Ingrid.
Hi there. Great show this morning. I just wanted to make a comment on the whole theory of this and tell you how much I agree with you, as well as I think every trauma or mishap is an opportunity for growth. And I think we as humans tend to back away from that because it can be painful. So very important to stay open. And also, like you said about changing your perspective of what's happened. One just very minor thing in my life that happened, I was going through a divorce and had a dog that I couldn't keep and found a family that could keep it, but the dog ended up getting lymphoma, and I really blamed myself at the time for the dog getting this disease because if I had done better. So I think it's also really important to, when we look back, realize that we did the best at the time, like you were talking about with being in a relationship, and know that it's a learning process, and, you know, there's so many lessons in it, like acceptance and forgiveness of yourself and having compassion for yourself. So I think those are all really key elements for changing the way that you look at things. And lastly, I think a lot of times it's easier to go into that victim mode, but we have to realize that that's always a choice. Anytime we look at things the way we do, it's a choice, and there's a lot of power in knowing that.
Thank you, Ingrid. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, you know, there's so much that Ingrid said that was so powerful. I could hardly capture it all, but the idea of keeping an open mind, not quickly closing oneself off, because, you know, people who choose to be victims, you know, if let's take the divorce case again and the husband, the son of a gun, this is what he did to me. He cheated with this woman. He went off. He did this. Now he's, you know, not paying his stuff and whatever. And now I'm not saying any of that is pleasant to deal with. It's awful to be betrayed. It's awful not to be treated well. But you can make it more awful for yourself by becoming a victim and dwelling on it. And when I said earlier, tell a story that brings a narrative and makes explicable the details of your life, when I said that, then what needs to happen is that story needs to change. Because if you tell the same tale with the same words again and again and again, nothing's changing in the way you're thinking about it, and so you're not really evolving in your concept of it. So those are some of the things that I would say that Ingrid's comments triggered in me.
Well, I also was touched by the lessons that she learned from this particular trauma was to forgive herself, to have compassion for herself.
You know, I think that's really, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And, you know, when I heard that, it made me realize, and, you know, the thing about doing these things is they don't always respond to instructions. You know, like, okay, now forgive yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's not always that easy. I, for example, in a previous book of mine, Transcendence, which is all about transcendental meditation, I had taken a lease on some space for my business, which was a pharmaceutical drug trials business. And just after I had made that commitment, the economy pulled right back, and the drug companies were not giving out trials, and I was stuck with an expensive lease that couldn't be justified in a business way. And I blamed myself, and I felt really badly that I'd made a bad judgment. And one day, while I was meditating in that lovely transcendent state that you get into, I said to myself, you know, this is really unfair to look in retrospect and make judgments. At the time, it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. It seemed like a sensible thing to do. We only understand history backwards. We don't understand it forwards. So it's time to forgive yourself. And I did. And I honestly never revisited that question in a blaming sense ever again. So yes, forgive yourself, but sometimes you need a little help, and meditation can be one of those things that can help you to forgive yourself.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He is the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. And our next caller is Julie in Elm Grove. Hello, Julie.
Hi. This is the first time I've ever called into your show. So I'm a little bit nervous, but I have a story that is kind of interesting, and I really, really like this topic today because I so believe in what the doctor's talking about. In my mid-30s, I was my husband died of cancer. I had three young children, and it was, you know, very sudden and tragic, and I just knew immediately that I wanted to go on and be happy, and it just came out of me in the moments of the diagnosis. And then a year and a half later, I married a man who had been widowed and lost his wife and two children in a tragic car accident, and we proceeded to piece our lives together, but we both had a very strong feeling of wanting to be happy, wanting to go forward, wanting to make a family, and we did do that, and we have three grown children now, which in the last year he adopted at their request, and we've moved on, and they've had grandchildren, and we've had a really, really great life together. But my question is, and I so agree with taking the attitude of, you know, of moving forward and being happy and needing that, wanting that in your life. But my question comes down to, in those moments, like anytime there's like a health scare in our family or something like that, I really go to that very dark place. I'm getting better at it. Every time it happens, I'm getting stronger about it. But my question would be, you know, what would the doctor recommend and how to think about those things as they occur?
Now, when you say think about those things, just sort of give me a little bit more guidance here.
Okay. I guess.
Give me an example.
Where to put it in my mind? You know, I know that I will never be totally over that fear of the rug being pulled out, you know, somebody very close to me getting desperately ill, and, you know, I can take a normal, like a blood test that one of my kids get that's a little bit off, and I can be, you know, kind of in that whirlwind of fear again.
I think there are so many people that live under the sword of Damocles. You know, people maybe who've had cancer, who need to go for checkups. I have a friend, he has to go every 6 months, and for the first 5 months out of the 6 months, he really cruises along and feels fine, and then in the last month, he begins to feel anxious. What is the test going to show? excuse me. Well, I think that the first thing to realize is that that anxiety is real. You're not going to be able to take it away. So just to accept that, that's part of the process of a situation where you're, you know, worried and waiting. And then also that anxiety isn't with you 100% of the time. It goes away sometimes. So then you can say, well, what was I doing when it went away? Well, I guess I was talking with my family, or I was playing mahjong with my friends. Mm-hmm. I'm just making up
right.
The examples here. But you learn patterns of behavior that help you to control the feelings that are scary. So on the one hand, to acknowledge them. The other hand, to do things that make them less. Reaching out to people and sharing is a very, very important way in which we make scary feelings less intense.
Julie, thank you for sharing that story. You've gone through an awful lot, and that that fear is understandable. Is there, Dr. Rosenthal, is there a way that we can become more resilient to hardship? Can we teach ourselves to be resilient?
Well, I think that's a really great question. And honestly, it's never been tested scientifically. But I do believe that one can. And one gets resilient by acquiring skills and tools. It's, you know, these video games that these kids and now adults play. You know, you acquire a certain tool, and that enables you to do certain things. You get a certain powerful ally, and that enables you to do certain things. I think they really are based on life. These things are based on life, and they, you know, they are really part of how we become more resilient. For example, if you can reach out and get some help, you'll be more resilient. Let's look at somebody I know where the couple has a young boy and now they've got twins. Well, it's a very difficult thing because everybody's waking up and everybody needs to be fed and so on and so forth. Well, fortunately, they could get the help they needed. That's actually made them more resilient because they've got more hands on deck. And I just think that's a model. I think there are a lot of competent people, but they put too much pressure on themselves. They don't give themselves a break, you know? They don't give themselves a break for recognizing they're only human and they can only do a certain amount. But then there are other things. And I think, for example, meditation has made me more resilient. How come? Because a lot of our brain is being taken off all the time on little anxieties and little frustrations that take us away from what needs to be done. And if we can get those little anxieties settled down, whether it's by meditation, whether it's by any other of the techniques that I mentioned in the book, then we have more of our brain available to do the things that really matter, and then we become more resilient.
We are talking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. When he was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, he was the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose SAD, or seasonal affective disorder, and he pioneered the use of light therapy to treat SAD. We are talking with him about his most recent book, The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. And we're wondering, what adversity have you experienced, and what have you learned from it? Do you agree that there's something to learn from every setback or from adversity? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What can we learn when bad things happen to us? We are talking with a guest who says there's a lot to gain, to the point where we can even consider adversity a gift. And we welcome your questions for Dr. Norman Rosenthal, who is the author of The Gift of Adversity. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones. We have Victoria with us. Victoria calls from West Central Wisconsin. Hello, Victoria.
Hello.
Yes, you have a story to share?
I do. About 11 years ago, I was 19 years old, and I was raped, date raped. And, of course, I went through a stage where I just felt very sad and felt very much like a victim. But I began eventually to think about what it was that put me and the young man in that situation, and what caused that. And I began to realize that very much in the media and in just in the last sort of 20 years of history, that women are very much seen as a commodity and valuable only for their sexuality. And with that realization, for me, came power. And I just felt so much like I could take control of myself, of my being, and really, really become a part of the world and take responsibility for what it was that had happened to me, and also for where I would go with my life. And so at this point, as a woman and as a human being, I feel so much that if this hadn't happened to me, I would be completely different and perhaps never would have harnessed that control. And so I really appreciate what you're doing, Dr. Rosenthal, because I feel like for anyone in a marginalized position of any kind, especially, it's so important to realize that it's not necessarily imperative to avoid these situations. Obviously, my situation would be great if you could avoid a lot of that. But because they're going to happen, bad things essentially are going to happen. It's important to take that and learn from it and realize that you can become more.
Wow. Dr. Rosenthal?
You know, I can hardly say anything because Victoria has said it all so well. Yeah. But I would like to say what an important distinction Victoria has made between blaming herself and saying, okay, what were the circumstances that permitted this event to happen or that enabled this event to happen? Just an analysis of the situation so that you understand the dynamics of it, how it came about, and where to go from there. And she's come up with these really fascinating conclusions about how to be more empowered. I know I spoke with a young woman about the pressures of being a girl in high school, a senior or a junior, and she says the pressures to put out sexually are just horrible, that the feeling is that, you know, if you don't, you'll be at a competitive disadvantage in relation to the other girls who are doing that, and how to claim your own powers and be who you are and not feel like, you know, the behavior of men towards you. And you know, we're talking about testosterone-infused young adolescent men. That should not be the determinant of your sense of self-worth. So I think Victoria is just raising these incredibly interesting questions that may not have come about had it not been for what was undoubtedly a horrible adversity. So it just, when I hear this kind of resonance in other people, it really makes me realize that something that was kind of obvious was actually not all that obvious, and that we're creating a public conversation around this, and in the process, hopefully empowering people who didn't as easily and instinctively reach the kinds of empowering conclusions that Victoria did.
Victoria, thank you for the call. This reminds me some of the story in the book about your cousin John, who went to work in helping people recover from trauma after he was imprisoned and tortured. Tell that story.
Yes, it's a really amazing story. You know, he had gone up against the apartheid government. He'd done some things that got him into trouble. And they were minor things. I mean, they were things that in any democracy would have been completely okay, like having friends of a different race come over to sleep at you, or, you know, having books on your shelf by authors that are against the government, or that sort of thing. I mean, you know, it's not like he put a bomb anywhere or anything, but it was enough for the paranoid fascist government to, you know, imprison him without trial, lock him up, torture him, and I go into detail about that, sleep deprive him, try to drive him to suicide because they would do those kinds of things, and then they would leave razor blades lying around. And it was just a terrible trauma, and those were terrible times. And yet, when he came out and he went to England, he became a psychotherapist, and he established a foundation for treatment of torture victims, and has used his understanding and knowledge of trauma and its consequences in his practice and in his work, and once again has tried to take the adversity, terrible adversity in this case, and turn it into a gift.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Daniel in Minong with us now. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. When I was 7, I suffered a botched elective surgery, gangrene from the knee down, and amputation. I used to say it was the worst thing that ever happened to me and the best thing. I would have been another person without the horror of gangrene and amputation, not me. All other pain I've experienced since then is relative and very minor.
Well, another story. And, you know, there's an article by an oral surgeon, and what he's found is that, you know, oral surgery for mouth cancer and jaw cancer can be very disfiguring. And incidentally, I'm really sorry for what you had to go through. But I am really impressed, as I am so often, by how people can process things. And what this oral surgeon found in a major survey of people's attitudes is that they found meaning in their suffering. And they developed belief systems that were very strong and supported them through all their lives. And I think that's just great. I really do.
Next, we go to Marcia in Grafton. Hello, Marcia.
Hello. Thank you. Yes, I have had multiple tragedies in my life with multiple suicides in the family and other horrible things going on. But the very most instructive and most difficult time in my life was when I struggled with my alcoholic father for my mother's care as she descended into Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that it taught me was to know that I was worthy of good self-care, that I needed to look for my complicity in any trouble that comes my way, to find my voice. And that led me to know true forgiveness and reconciliation. And I was really struck by Dr. Rosenthal's comment early on in the program about the importance of writing some of this down. And I made a promise when I was almost at the end of my rope that I would write something on paper every day, even if it was only one word, if that's all I had the energy for. And that did lead to so many important discoveries. And it also led to my memoir, which is titled God Never Hurries. And trust and patience is really needed in this whole process.
What important observations. Firstly, the power of writing. Secondly, the need to be willing to wait and be tenacious with your hopes and your dreams. And I love the title of your memoir. I think it's just great. God Never Hurries, because really, you do have to wait sometimes a long time. I was just staggered yesterday when Dr. Higgs got his Nobel Prize for his Higgs boson for physics, 84 years old. For work done in 1964.
Wow.
How wonderful. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it was because the CERN reactor actually demonstrated the existence of this Higgs boson all these years later, what's that, 50 years? And, of course, he could have died, but he didn't. And how wonderful to have your work validated, even if you have to wait so many years for it to happen. And I think that life is often like that. And those of us who have the good fortune to live long enough to see our work reach fruition are very lucky. I think of the wonderful poet Emily Dickinson, who published only a few poems in her lifetime, or Vincent van Gogh, who sold only a couple of paintings and have gone on to become amongst the most famous in their areas. But I think those of us who are lucky enough to live long enough to see the fruits of our labor are very, very fortunate.
That's right. Marcia, thank you for the call. You know, Marcia talked about her alcoholic father. People listening now may have had abusive parents or loved ones that were abusive. You dealt, too, with your father's PTSD. What can you learn from such adversity?
Well, I think what I can learn, firstly, I learned a lot about PTSD itself. The fact that it doesn't present itself as a simple linear story. I had to reconstruct it all after his death, as I explain in the book. He'd been in a war, and during the war, he'd lost his mother, his father, and his brother. All died in different ways. His brother died a hero. He's part of my hero's story. I'm named after him. Norman Rosenthal died in North Africa. And then his mother died of a burst appendix, and his father died of grief, basically. And so in a very short space of time, his whole family was pretty much wiped out. And he actually never recovered. And a lot of the quirks and strange behaviors, I can really pinpoint down to that sequence of events and the way in which he handled it. And obviously there was no help available. People didn't know about PTSD. There was no help available for it. And so he suffered terribly, treated his suffering with whiskey, which of course didn't make it any better. And so I draw the character out. And you know, it was interesting writing about him because when I said goodbye to him, when I left South Africa, he was in the hospital bed having had a heart attack. And I didn't know if I'd ever see him again. And then after I left, I remembered him saying to me, he said, you know, when you go to America, you write about us, you know, because we're a bunch of characters, you know.
Well, you wrote about it. And I'm afraid to say, Dr. Rosenthal,
gave me permission.
Yeah, we're at the end of the program. Thank you very much for being with us and sharing the gift of adversity. Norman Rosenthal is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He is the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.